Well, that's kind of the theme of randomness, where we think things make sense. We can perceive continuity where there isn't any. And this is where we'll start, we can hope that there really is order in the chaos. And we cleave to the order, we ignore the chaos that's all around us. So argues Leonard Mlodinow. The book is The Drunkard's Walk. We'll explain the title coming up. It's how randomness rules our lives. And yet, in the chaos, there is still order. It's almost with the level of probabilities being what they are, there is still order. It's fascinating. It's kind of mind-bending. You're going to have a great time tonight with this conversation. I guarantee that, or as much as I can guarantee anything. Random universe coming up next on Coast to Coast AM. This is Ian Punnett. Well, Leonard Mlodinow, am I close on that pronunciation, by the
very,
way?
Very good. Thank you.
Okay. That was a guess. That was an absolute guess. But I love the book. I'm a new fan, and I couldn't help but go back over and review a lot of your other work too. So I look forward to both talking about randomness and then bringing in some other aspects of your resume into the conversation about The Drunkard's Walk, how randomness rules our lives. Are you okay with that?
That sounds good to me.
Okay, first of all, have you seen the new Star Trek?
Well, I wrote the cover story for Newsweek, the May 4th issue on Star Trek.
So you had already seen.
That's a funny story. Talk about randomness. I was writing about the history of the franchise, and I used to write for Star Trek: The Next Generation, and so I had some funny stories, and I wrote this article about the franchise and why I thought it had remained popular over all the years. And they said, here, go to Paramount and see the movie. You can take your family, but you don't go in because we don't want you to go in until you finish the article because we don't want you to comment on the movie. So I took them. They all loved the movie. I'm sitting there outside waiting for them to come out, and then some lady from Paramount says, "Why aren't you in there?" I said, "I was told not to go in there." And she says, "No, I want you to go in there. And she said, "Well, it's too late now, so I'll get you some passes to go, in the next few days." And then I called New York, Newsweek, where I told them the story, and they said, "Well, you weren't." They said you weren't supposed to go in there. And then she said, "I'm supposed to go in there." And then I never got the passes. So I don't know, but I plan to see it soon. But the kids
So you
loved it.
still haven't seen it, bottom
No,
line, but your
I haven't.
kids
Bottom
did.
line is, I still haven't seen it. But I sat outside and listened to the exclamations, and everyone seemed to have a good time.
It's fabulous. It was just really interesting to watch it be. And I guess the producers or directors are reluctant to call it a reimagining of Star Trek, but I think it's fair to say that it is at least, if not a reimagining of it, it pushes the original through a very interesting filter. I mean, it's not completely reconcocted, but it has some twists that are not part of the original threads.
Yeah, I think that's one of the reasons for the vitality of the franchise. It has been reinvented, before, and it's always with great imagination. And that was my theory, was that Star Trek stays successful because it has a kind of a culture of imagination behind it. And I heard that I guess this new one actually changes history, right? And then explains it with some kind of time warp. So,
Yeah,
I don't know,
yeah.
parallel universe thing. So
Right.
I'm looking forward to seeing it, but I probably won't be real soon before we copy that in physics.
Yeah, but it's definitely anchored more to the original than I thought it was going to be. I mean, it has a real strong connection to the original in so many ways, including the casting and the acting choices by many of the actors. When that young Kirk walks onto the bridge, you'd swear it's somebody doing a Shatner impersonation. It's almost like Kevin Pollak doing Shatner in a way in certain moments. It's really cool. It's really nicely done. So that's just, again, one part of Leonard Mlodinow's career is as a Hollywood writer, also as a professor at a collegiate level on physics, theoretical physics. Bright guy, obviously. And so let's talk about randomness. Define for people who are either unfamiliar with the concept or terrified by the term, what you mean by randomness.
Okay, well, let me define what I mean by a random process, which means something that's occurring, and whether we call it random or not random. And not random, I would use the word deterministic for that. And something that's deterministic means that whatever is going on, it will have a definite result. And you can say with 100% whether or not you actually have the, you know, the ability to make all the measurements you need, but in theory, it's 100% has a definite result. And something that's random is a process where you can't say what the definite result is, but there are a number of possibilities, each of which all you can do at best is assign a probability. So it's a random process. If you don't know what the result is, or you can't say, but you can only assign a probability to each possible result.
Well, let's
it's context dependent. I guess it's important to say that it's context dependent, because say if you're flipping a coin, you're going to flip a coin, and if you can control your thumb perfectly well and how you put the coin on your thumb, and some people tell me they can do this. I've never actually seen anyone do it, but they can flip the coin and get, say, heads or tails every time. But for most of us, this is the archetypical random process, but because we can't do that, we don't know how it's going to come up, and so we call it a random process. And even if it's a weighted coin that might come up 75% heads and 25% tails, that's still a random process. It's described a little bit differently than if it were 50-50.
So let's use another context for this. Let's say you're taking a hammer and you're pounding a nail into a wooden board. Would it be deterministic to say that when you hit the nail with the hammer, it will go at least slightly further into the wood? Or are we still talking about randomness when we're talking about something as simple as pounding a nail into a wooden board?
I think if you're sober when you're hitting the nail, it's probably, I would say it's not, I would say it is deterministic, you know, because you, if you believe that it definitely will go in a little bit, which I believe in this case, and I would say it's deterministic. If you want to take into account missing the nail or something else going on, which might happen 1 in 1,000 times, then you could say that it's random in that, to that extent.
Okay, good. Now, I'll come back to that analogy later on.
Okay.
Well, no, I want to – actually, you tripped onto it for me there by talking about if one is sober. So that brings us to the title, The Drunkard's Walk. Explain that.
Oh, that's true.
Great metaphor.
Well, that's a mathematical term, which describes at times mathematicians, but they use it to describe a certain kind of a random process, which is also called a random walk. And that is a process where something is moving but taking turns in random directions. So you might imagine being on a tabletop and let's say a ball rolling on a tabletop, and for some reason it moves, you know, a little bit to the left, a little bit to the right, back, forth, and just randomly, and it traces out some kind of a path. And that path is called the drunkard's walk. And I thought that was a good metaphor for our path in life, because even though we have a certain intended direction, superimposed upon that are little nudges this way and that way, that we that move us in unpredicted, uncontrollable directions and take us off of the path we might be aiming for. And if you look at this kind of a path, if something moves randomly, you'll get some surprises, because for one thing, it'll start somewhere and it'll end somewhere somewhere else normally. And so even something that's moving totally at random, that illustrates how that can still get somewhere. And if you look at the path for a while and see where the thing's going, you'll find that at times it's moving in some direction. If it's on a plane, let's say northeast for a while, and then it'll move some other direction, and sometimes it'll bunch up and stay in one area. And if you didn't know that it was random, you might think that when it was moving northeast that it was moving through some intention or some reason, and it's really just the flukes of randomness that make it go in one way for a while, and it's the same flukes of randomness that make it stop and explore some area and linger in some area for a while. And so when it's something that you know is mathematically generated, you go, well, it's random, and that's how it behaves. But when it happens in the real world, we tend to assign causes to everything we see. When something's moving in some direction, when something's lingering, or this is, you know, metaphorically in our lives, if things are happening that they seem to have a real cause, when in reality a lot of times that they're just by chance.
Okay, I'm reminded of the Jeff Goldblum character in Jurassic Park,
right?
Okay, yeah. The chiatician, as he calls himself, right? As he's and he's into chaos theory, and he drops a little bit of water on the hand of the Laura Dern character, and one time it goes left, the other time it goes right, and he talks about the randomness of the universe in that context. Where are you with chaos theory, and how does that help inform us on this?
Well, chaos theory is related, but it doesn't necessarily really, it can be deterministic. It doesn't have to be a random process, but it really, the key there is that in order to predict what's going to happen, you have to know the laws that govern that process, right? And for instance, if they're Newton's laws, then they're the ordinary laws of everyday physics. And those laws, the laws of everyday physics, are deterministic. They predict with certainty. If you know all the initial conditions, the way things are now, and you know the laws, and you have a good computer, you can predict with certainty how things will turn out. But what sometimes happens is that, of course, we never know the initial conditions exactly, with exact precision. There's always a little bit of, let's say, experimental error, observational error, and certainly in everyday life we don't know the conditions exactly, and we can't also insulate the system from outside influences exactly or totally. So what happens is we can't really use what I just said, because you have these imprecisions.
Yeah.
And in a system that would behave nicely, those little imprecisions in isolating the system and in knowing the initial conditions would cause little changes down the road in the predictions, and everything would be nice, and you could still make pretty accurate predictions. In a chaotic system, a little change in the initial conditions will cause a huge change later on in the way the system behaves. So what that means is that, in a sense, it's essentially a random behavior, because you can't predict the outcome, even though theoretically you could predict the outcome. Since you can't know the conditions you can't really predict the outcome. That's why we can't predict the weather more than a couple of days in advance, because those equations are very sensitive to knowing all the initial conditions, and we just can't measure enough. We can't measure them precisely enough, and in enough geographical areas to really allow prediction past a few days.
Too many variables.
Too much sensitivity to our knowledge. You know, to our initial, how a system's initially set up.
Well, but also the variables then in weather patterns. It can just be 3 degrees this way or 4 degrees that way.
Right. Variables in our knowledge, yeah.
Right.
And in our knowledge. And in fact, that's how chaos was first discovered. Well, not first, because it was actually, there's a longer history, but the modern interest in it was this fellow who was doing in the 60s computer modeling of weather. And he ran his model, given some initial conditions, for several days. And then he decided, I want to run it for several more. I ran for 5 days. I want to run it for 10 days. But why should I bother to start at day one and run it for 10 days? I'm going to start at like day four, take my, take the readout from day four from that other run, and I'll do it for 6 days from there, and I'll get the rest of it. And then he noticed that when he did that, the overlap between his initial run and his later run was very bad. Was very poor, and it was like it totally gave him a different answer for that last time. And then he realized that what happened was that the computer could only hold the data to a certain number of digits, and the rest it threw away. And the initial conditions were provided, and then it was calculating things. But then when you throw away those other digits and put in those as new initial conditions, you get a totally different answer. I mean, just not keeping the fifth and sixth decimal place would make a change in the first decimal place 2 days later. And that was the discovery that of this kind of behavior.
Very interesting. Now, I think that, and I promised that we would start this conversation as this pertains to Wall Street, as we're just talking about the kind of the variations in our economy and how our perception of our economy helps drive the economy. And that goes directly to what you're talking about perceptions of control in the drunkard's walk, that we need to feel that we are in control, or that there is some sort of control on the world. And when there isn't, we insert one, that we're inclined to insert what may be just a mythical perception that there is some control going on. And that really came, a lot of it had to do with the economy and how people were feeling about Wall Street. Can you talk about that?
Yeah, well, people, humans have evolved to a point where control in their brain is the control over the situation is very important to people. I mean, there's a study of nursing homes where one group of patients was treated normally, where they just living in their room, and another group was given control over their environment, where they could have the furniture rearranged. They had to water their own plants and other things, so they had a lot more control. And they were studied for 18 months, and the group that had more control lived significantly longer than the other group.
It was staggering, actually. I mean, the one group was told they couldn't, they had no control over their environment.
It was just normal, where they don't really, I guess, you know, you don't normally, you're in a nursing home, rearrange furniture and everything's
right.
Done for you, and that was just done normally. And the other group, they were given specific areas of control where they said, no, you have to take care of this, you have to take care of that. I mean, you know, or you have, you, I guess you have the right to take care of, but you have to take, you have to make all these decisions now. So it's like as if it were your home, and
right.
they live considerably longer.
Yeah, and so that
in the
somehow
concentration camps, there were people who wrote it. Of course, there weren't studies done, but on some of the writings afterwards, they said that one of the things that helped people get through were the people who could find and manage to keep some kind of control over their lives, even though that was very hard at the time.
Even if it was just the smallest thing that
right.
they felt like they had control over, that they invested more in it.
And what's interesting is that so this is very important to us, but there have also been studies done where they say, okay, does that translate into the way you view the world? And it's amazing how it does. One interesting study, they used four different playing cards, and they had a bag which contained one of those playing cards, okay? So the bag has one particular card in it of these four. Then they took two groups of subjects. And to let's say, group A, the experimenter would, let me just say that each of these subjects would get a card, and if the card matched the card in the bag, they would get, say, $4, okay? So there's a 1 in 4 chance that your card's going to match, and you win $4 if it does match. So on average, you win $1 each play, right? Because you have a 1/4 chance of winning $4. Okay? So what the experimentalists would do, they would say, okay, how much do you want for me to buy that card back from you after you got your card? Okay, so they would ask you, they would allow you to sell your card back and ask you how much you want for it. So the card should be worth $1 because of what I said. But then they divide them into two groups. So half, group A, these subjects, it worked this way. The experimentalist gave them a card and said, here's the card. I'm picking one of these four, giving it to you. Here you are. If it matches, then you get the $4. Group B, they said, you pick your own card, whichever one you think matches, and if it matches, you get $4. Now, we know as humans, I mean, intellectually, that it doesn't really matter, right? There's an unknown
right.
card in the bag. You're getting one card, and it doesn't really change things. But then when they ask, how much do you want, how much money do you want to sell me the card back, group A, where they were given a card, averaged, group B, they got to choose its own card, asked on the average 4 times as much money for their card as group A, which was given a card.
So when they felt like they had chosen their own card, that card had more value because they chose it, and they were able to, or felt that they were able to sell it because they thought it was more valuable because they were invested in its choice, whereas the people that were merely handed one at random felt like, okay, well then here, this is just worth what you gave to me, even
yeah,
though there was no, it had no variation, no relation to what they would win at the end.
Right, and if you had asked them, you know, intellectually, I'm sure they would all say it doesn't matter if you give me one or if I choose it, right?
Right.
But that's
right.
How, and, you know, there was another experiment where.
Well, hold on. We're just gonna have to hang out for a second. We'll come back to that. The Drunkard's Walk by Leonard Mlodinow is ranked by Amazon as one of the 10 best science books of 2008. It's out in paperback now, but describing The Drunkard's Walk as a science book would be like saying The Perfect Storm is a book about yachting. Yeah, it is, but it's more than that. It's really entertaining, and you ought to pick it up. It's it explains so much, challenges a lot, but also, well, it sort of breaks apart the order of things and also kind of puts it back together again in a different order. That's all I can say for now. But let's get back to the conversation about Wall Street next. We'll talk about the number of Wall Street firms that get paid huge amounts of money, individual Wall Street analysts that make millions of dollars to not do what they say they can do, because Wall Street is one of the best examples of randomness in the universe. Next on Coast to Coast AM, this is Ian Punnett. Leonard Mlodinow, the author of The Drunkard's Walk, formerly a story editor and a writer for Star Trek The Next Generation, and also wrote an episode of What's Happening Now.
True. Oh, boy. Now
talk about random.
Talk about random. Night Court also. That was a little bit better.
Okay. Night Court, I can almost see What's Happening Now. Okay. Tell me about a Jewish kid from Chicago with a PhD writing What's Happening Now.
Who would have known?
Okay. So very interesting to me. I'm sure if there's no reason to be ashamed of that, there's no, but I just wouldn't have, who would have expected that would have happened. So we were talking, you were in an analogy, but I cut you short because I was trying to focus on the Wall Street thing, but I didn't want to keep you from going back to that if you wanted to.
Well, I thought it was another fun study that made the same point, because when I would, you know, read the study like the one that I described with the betting on the cards in the bag, you go, that can't be true. I mean, you know, people know better, and how can they be, you know, as one psychologist said, they might know that it's random, but they behave as if they can control it. And so, you know, I read a number of studies, and they're all, to me, they're all just astounding. And this other one, briefly, were Yale students who were asked to predict coin flips. And so they would, you know, predict a bunch of coin flips, and after that, going through that, they would be asked a battery of questions. And, you know, if you had asked them, can you predict or control the way the coin flips? You know, of course, they would have said no. That's the conscious part of it, right, the intellectual part. But in the gut feeling, again, they felt they could. And the way that was brought out was they asked them slightly more subtle questions, like, you know, would you your performance get better if you practiced? And like 40% said yeah. And, you know,
practicing a coin toss.
Controlling the
practicing
coin. So that's why when we see similar things happening in the real world, especially in the stock market, we there's a great tendency to feel that these people do, you know, can predict and control, especially when we see people guessing right sometimes, you know. And so one story I talk about in Drunkard's Walk is the story of Bill Miller, who was quite a hero for many years and lauded constantly in all sorts of publications about his great abilities in stock picking, when his mutual fund beat the Standard & Poor's index for 15 years in a row. And, you know, I found articles quoting the odds of anyone doing that at, you know, 100,000-1, 300,000-1, 1,000,000,000-1. And, you know, they called him the greatest financial analyst of the modern mutual fund history, the last 40 years, and all sorts of things. And, of course, he made a ton of money. And so, you know, I still looked at it and I said, well, is this a case of someone flipping the coin and, you know, and getting it right? And then, you know, calling the coin a genius for landing on heads, you know,
right,
15 times in a row. So I did a simple calculation. All you have to do is you just say, let's take the last 40 years in a row, and how many, you know, stock pickers are at work, how many mutual funds are there at a time? And there's 5,000 or 6,000 now. There were somewhat less earlier. I just took a very conservative estimate. I said, let's take 1,000, because one of these articles said there were 1,000 comparable funds. So I said, let's suppose that there's 1,000 funds working over 40 years, and each time they're trying to beat the Standard & Poor's. What are the chances that some one of them, if they were just flipping coins rather than, you know, than doing all that they do, they're just flipping coins, that they would flip heads 15 years in a row, one of these 1,000. Or, you know, you might imagine that they buy the whole portfolio of Standard & Poor's, close their eyes and blindly pick one of the stocks and take it out of that portfolio, throw a dart and pick a stock, delete it from the standard, from their index, and then they'd have like a 50% chance of beating it. They could do something that simply, you know. So what are the chances they were doing that, of beating it or of getting heads, you know, 15 more years in a row?
Right.
So it turns out that, you know, if you pick any one of them, any one of these coin tossers in any particular 15-year period, the chances are 1 in 2 to the 15th, or about 1 in 30,000, very low, that guy for those years will do it. But then when you factor in that for those 15 years, there's 1,000 of them doing it, it becomes about 3%, which is not that low. But
it makes it doable. It makes it doable, the idea that one guy could do that for that period of time.
It makes it doable for that period, that 15-year period. But they've been trying for more than one 15-year period. So then when you factor in the fact that they've been trying this for 40 years, the chances that one of them, for some particular 15 or more period in a row, would win all those times are about two out of three. So like a 65, 67% chance that someone would have done it. So I say that, you know, the headline shouldn't have said Bill Miller, you know, greatest genius at picking stocks, but, you know, expected 15-year run finally occurs, Bill Miller, right, lucky beneficiary.
Right.
It's kind of like calling the coin smart for coming up heads 15 times in a row.
Well, and I think that's really important because, as you point out, that these Wall Street firms that make million, hundreds of millions, billions of dollars that are in trouble that we were bailing out are generally, right, don't do any better than just an average of the Wall Street stocks.
No, and that's another thing that just really annoyed me. It's such a scam. I mean, if you look, you're watching TV and you see, you know, the Barron's Wall Street Superstars, or you see Wall Street Week and all these shows with all these great, you know, these experts who, by the way, at the end of the 90s, at least, they were making on the average $3 million apiece, right?
Right.
So they've been, you know, economists have done studies of those shows and found that they don't do better at all than the average and the Standard & Poor's. In fact, Wall Street Week significantly lagged the average.
Well, let's pull that out a little bit. Let's focus on that. Wall Street Week, the TV show, they did a study of Wall Street Week, the TV show, and the stocks that they picked on that show, and it did worse than Wall Street did on average with the Standard & Poor's.
I think the words they used were lagged far behind the market.
Yeah. I mean, that's just, these are the big
people are watching. I mean,
right.
Put me on there, you know?
Right. Put a monkey on there. Put anybody on there. And it's good. If it does worse, then what's the point in gathering all of these brilliant, you know, talking heads that are getting paid huge amounts of money who will do worse than just the random average?
Well, yeah, and then look at Cramer, you know, of course, right. I think John Stewart did a great job with him. But,
yeah, he did.
But you know, before Bear Stearns debacle, he's telling people to buy Bear Stearns, you know. And, you know, I've found so much evidence of that. There was a researcher at Harvard did a study of 153 newsletters, investment newsletters, found no evidence of stock picking ability.
Anybody.
Yeah.
In any of these news. And you look at what's happened since your book was originally published in hardcover, so now it's out in paperback, is you got Bernie Madoff. And here you have somebody that was returning something greater than Wall Street could have, and people were handing over money, but he had to cheat to do it. Well, he was a ripoff artist.
He had the secret, though. That's how you do it. That is the key.
The secret being?
If you cheat, you get inside information, or you do a Ponzi scheme.
Right.
There you go.
You can do better, but nobody else will. So I think that's why it's just so fascinating to look at that. And as Wall Street's getting all this big bailout money, we think it's because if we keep these institutions afloat, we keep these big minds working, you know, and Wall Street's always making an argument about, hey, we have to keep these people because if we don't give them their big end of the year bonuses, they're going to walk and then you're going to lose the benefit of what they can do. And they can't do jack.
Well, that's true. But, you know, in those cases, what they end up with, these very complicated instruments that banks are owning, and they need people who understand what they are just in order to untangle the mess. Otherwise, they ended up with owning these, the banks ended up having a portfolio of these complicated derivatives and not having anyone who even knows what they mean. Of course, I'm not sure how much they understand it anyway, the people who are the so-called experts at it. But
why don't they just close the file on the derivatives, not touch them, and see how they do in 5 years without anybody trying to, quote-unquote, manage them?
I think what they're trying to do is figure out what they're worth so they can
break them up and sell them?
Or at least know where the banks stand, have some way of knowing what their, you know, what their risks are and what their future holds, but or how much money they're going to need to stay afloat. But I don't really know.
Well, then again, I understand. But it's an interesting exposition on the randomness of Wall Street and how we bring, again, a sense of meaning or the ability to control that may not exist. And another example of that.
Before this happened, this debacle, when I would be talking to people about this, they'd be so skeptical. And they go, oh, are you telling me that the guy can have 15 years in a row beat the beat the, you know, the index, and,
right.
and that could be, you know, that that's just a fluke. How could that, you know?
Right.
And now people are, of course.
of course. Yeah. Now you're like, tell me something I don't know, Leonard.
I have an interesting graph in the book where I take took this top 800 mutual funds and ranked them from one to, on the left side of the graph and going, let's say, horizontally to 800 on the right. And the vertical axis, you show their return. So obviously it's high on the left side, and it goes down in some smooth way to the lower, to the, you know, to the bottom fund on the right. And of course, that was based over 5 years. And people, when they pick mutual funds, they go back and they look at the last 3 or 5 years, and you can go online and you always get these graphs, and they want to pick one that did well. Well, the question is deterministic or is it random? So the point is, does the past predict the future? So if I have this nice ranking, what does that tell me about the next 5 years? Well, so I looked at some in the past, so I could look at the next 5 years because I have the next 5 years data because that was in the past, right? So you look at keep the same rankings now, but now you graph instead of what they did over the last 5 years, you graph what they did over the next 5 years, and if things were deterministic, were not random, or if there was a real reason for this, you'd expect pretty much the same looking graph on the vertical axis, right? That the number one would be the number one or near there,
right.
And it would kind of be up high, and it would smoothly go down to the bottom like it did before. In the
right.
book, you look at the graph, it's like random noise. It's just like
right.
all over the map, and it doesn't have much correlation. And, you know, that's because they don't, you know, some will do better and some will do worse, but it's meaningless. And if you look in the future, just like the coin, one coin might get a few heads, one coin might get a few tails. It doesn't mean in the future they're going to keep getting heads and the other one's going to keep getting tails. It just mixes up.
Somebody sent me an image of a Roomba vacuum cleaner. And they put a camera on a long-term exposure in a room, and they let the Roomba go all over the room. And it's a great metaphor for the randomness of things.
Yeah, it's probably doing a drunkard's walk, you know.
And it's totally doing a drunkard's walk,
yeah.
Right. Yeah. So, but again, talking about randomness here, and there's so many examples, and I'm looking forward to this conversation, but I'm also looking forward to opening up the phones later on, because I know that there's going to be a lot of people who, well, maybe there will be, people that do that unusual thing where they bring control to the chaos by making an argument for the particular. So, you know, for example, if you ask the average American how they feel about Congress, they might rank Congress, they may have very low opinion of Congress. Ask the person how they feel about their individual Congress person, and they'll go, oh, well, I think so-and-so is a great guy.
Mm-hmm.
So, you know, and it's kind of the same way with a lot of the financial managers. They may think, well, Wall Street's all crazy. Who can make any sense of it? Thank God I've got Bob managing my money.
I have run into that. Yes, I have. Yeah.
Yeah. And so there really isn't at any level anybody that can really do it, as you're arguing. It's just that people will get lucky. They'll have good years and they'll have bad years. They'll bring some level of expertise to it, but in the end, they really can't control it.
No, they can't. They can't predict it. And you know, and you know, if you study a certain industry and you believe in a company because you think the company is doing very well, I'm not saying that if you really believe that the company has a better product, that company is not going to. You know, that you shouldn't invest in that company, in that particular company. And if you study a lot of different companies in different areas, you might find companies that you believe in. But the bottom line is you don't really know. And the statistics show that you know, you try and do that in large scale, and it just all gets washed out. I mean, it's pretty random.
Well, and you use the example,
I mean, if you have inside information, of course, that
right.
What happens is once a company has an advantage, like Scholastic gets Harry Potter, and it gets known, the stock moves, right? If you know it ahead of time and trade on that's inside information, you can cheat and win. If you don't, the stock, you know, it comes out, the stock moves because of the sales, and it's that information is absorbed in the market. And then, you know, everyone knows it. The stock has already gone up, and there's not much you can do about it.
And so this idea, too, that you can make millions by these tiny fluctuations. That's what a lot of people invest in, this belief that if something moves 3 cents, 4 cents, you see these programs, they sell them on infomercials on late night television on how to make money with just the little minute variations, that there's a method to that madness.
Well,
and every time I look at that, I go, well, really? I mean, can you really do that? Because you think there'd just be a lot more billionaires out there if it were that easy.
Plus, why would these guys be going to all the trouble of doing infomercials instead of just doing it themselves and making the money, you know? and making the money. It's just like if a psychic says they can predict the stock, then you know, and then they're selling their information on an infomercial or on the web, and we go, well, just do it, and you can make as much money. You can make unlimited money if you could really predict the stock market. You don't need to sell your method.
Well, and then you bring up the example of Hollywood too. And you would know because you wrote an episode of the TV show Hunter, so you would know.
Boy, well, I have to say you've done.
So Leonard, let's talk about the woman who was in charge of Paramount, right? Sherry Lansing,
mm-hmm.
Right? Talk about that. I thought that was a really interesting metaphor for how we could look at randomness.
Well, Sherry Lansing had a number. I guess I should say that my theory on this, well, it's not really my theory, the theory that I believe, but economists have this theory, and they've studied box office returns a great deal. They've come to the conclusion, or a lot of them have, that you cannot predict, just as you can't predict the stock market, you can't really predict a movie's success. And by that, there are different levels of prediction that we're talking about, but the level that's relevant here is the prediction years in advance, or the prediction at the point of where you greenlight the money for the movie. So it's one thing to say the movie's done, it's not released yet, I'm going to look at it and say, how well do I think it's going to do? You know,
right.
Another thing to say, okay, let's invest $80 million, you know, I'm signing it off, here it goes, and let's get the movie going. And you haven't even, you know, shot it yet, you don't have a final script, you know, you're just getting it all set up and getting it going. And at that level, there's a lot of evidence that you really can't predict what's going to happen. And despite that, and for many reasons, I mean, you know, the might not get the right actors, the chemistry might not be right, the script might not quite come out the way you want it, the mood of the country might change, the weekend that it's coming out or that season might be full of other competitors or, you know, who knows what can happen, right? But despite that, what happens is the people who are running Hollywood studios aren't really rewarded the way, you know, they're not rewarded by how well they're running the studio, by, you know, the budgets being kept under control, how the schedule is, the thing being run professionally, but they're really rewarded on how well they can pick hits. That's all anyone talks about in Hollywood is if someone runs a studio, you know, are they have a hot hand or not at picking the hits. And so Sherry Lansing did very well for Paramount, I forget, for it was like maybe 9 years. She had a double-digit market share, and then she hit like a bad streak where it fell, you know, to like 6-7% for 3 years in a row. And suddenly, the headlines about her was, you know, she lost her touch and she's out of, you know, doesn't understand the culture and she was fired, right?
Okay, well, let's leave it right there as we go to the top of the hour.